Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
For Steph Wilson, the body is such a vast universe of paradoxes that will never get old. Traversing the space between fine art and fashion, Steph cherishes humour and joy while exploring the possibilities of our bodies. She is interested in the edges, the awkward, uncomfortable, ugly, shameful and challenging, and takes these elements to assert new modes of beauty and being. What I admire so much about Steph is her fierce insistence to push forward and experiment and rework the boundaries of the medium, while also being acutely aware of her emotional state and that of her collaborators.
The whole kind of point of the self-portraits was fun and exploratory stuff. You know, I wanted to see where my boundaries are with what actually made me uncomfortable.
I'm Jem Fletcher, and this is The Messy Truth, Conversations on Photography. London-based photographer Steph Wilson uses her work to challenge beauty norms and the pressures placed upon women's bodies. Shooting commercial, editorial, and personal work, her expansive practice has manifested into work for Gucci, Versace, Nike, Dazed and Confused, and Vogue Italia. Here you find us jumping right in, talking about how she started out in painting and how that went on to inform her photography.
I fled off to Liverpool with my then partner, who lived there. And just painted and painted, but I never did the Chelsea or Slade or Goldsmiths fine art route, which is what you have to do to be, you know, legit as such. So my point is, what I'm getting at is, like, I feel like there's the notion of a bit of a sellout kind of compromise to an extent, and I think it really lends itself to the fact that I think I'm quite not maybe lazy, but impatient. And I think with painting, it's like investing too much of your, like, it's such an emotional, personal thing, painting. It's such like a direct, physical, like tangible purge of yourself. Whereas I feel like photography has the safety net of like there being a contraption kind of translating it for you, or there's some distance generated, and it's easier to, and I think with something like fashion, to create that distance, it's kind of essential of like retaining some sense of sanity. Otherwise you'd just take everything so to heart and so badly. Whereas with painting, I was like, I don't know if I can give that away, if I can like commodify it, something so pure. And I know I have friends who are writers, a friend is a writer, and she's only just started writing, you know, but it's always been her, like, her love, you know, it's like her lover. And it's like, you don't want to taint it with the harsh realities of criticism and someone taking that purity away from it by, I don't know. So I think it's like, I love photography. I absolutely love it. And I feel like it should be seen as an art form. And I think it is all of these things, but it's just not painting to me. Mm-hmm. And I think keeping it that way keeps them both sacred in their own right, I guess. Photography is like the therapy to not painting. And the reason I don't paint is because I don't know. The intention was to always paint and to just do it, because I've always been of the mind of just do it and just make it and just do it, and things will happen if they're going to happen. But coming to London after I'd just broken up with my partner, and then my dad was diagnosed with cancer with 2 months to live, and it was all very up in the air, like nothing was solid anymore in any respect. And the idea of then just deciding to be a prolific painter in London when you had rent to pay, it just seemed so unreachably fast and far away. So photography was kind of, and it was always a part of the creative chain as such, because I'd take photographs to paint from, so it was just mm-hmm. cutting that chain shorter, and you know, and I think it suits me as maybe a person more anyway, just the kind of it's just, I don't know, how do you say it more artfully than it's just a bit quicker? How do you make it sound arty and good?
It's about the process though, isn't it, right? The process of it is completely different.
Well, the process is different, but then saying that, which is funny, because if I was actually, if I lent on that entirely, is I was down to, I mean, I'm not, it's not all down to what's quickest, because otherwise I'd shoot digitally. I don't, I shoot 120mm and I'm very, like, I'm not super purist about it. Some people are so purist that they get like, they like, look down the noses at people that don't shoot that way. And I've had photographers that look down the noses at me, and, you know, no names, but, you know, being like, who the hell do you think you are, saying I'm not a real photographer because I don't hand print myself. I work with Sarah England, who's my best friend and a much better hand printer than I am, and she does it under direction. But some people see that as like, oh, and you're like, who are you? But then, you know, the process of hand printing and shooting on film is long, so it's like I've sped it up, but then I've slowed it back down again and found some kind of middle ground of, because, you know, you could argue that hand printing in the dark room is like Harley literally did with her work with fluids and light refracting and bleeding, and so you're painting with light as such, so there's a kind of middle ground in there. I would never be able to purely be like a digital photographer. I find it so sterile and like clinical. It kind of never feels like your own when it's digital. It always feels like they just exist, like floating around somewhere, you know, in the cloud.
I'm curious of many things about you. I feel like there's a lot I don't know about you, even though I followed your work for a long time.
I feel like the whole world knows too much about me based on me just constantly filming my dogs.
Yeah, we know a lot about your animals. We know a lot about your zoo. Yeah. But I don't know that much about you. Like, I'm really interested if you're sort of ideology and creative approach to painting informs your photography.
I think it does, whether I think about it or not. I think it will have to. I think mainly in color.
Yeah
I used to have like a weird kind of very quite sexual relationship with like oil paint, in the way that I, you know, when you're a teenage kid and you imagine like fucking your art teacher in the art cupboard smothered in your red oil paint. My mum's a nurse, and so it was always very like pragmatic approach to bodies, and so I was always obsessed with blood and like just the kind of, I think I was obsessed with blood and the body, but I was also obsessed with the reactions that it would gauge from people at school, just being like so nonchalant about periods and weird body stuff, and everyone being like, and it was like, you know, I'm just one of those people, I think, that find that kind of thing funny, that there's such like a strong reaction to like the most literal, mundane, basic daily shit, literal shit.
Yeah.
and so I, you know, when it comes to like paint just feels like a clean, sanitized version of like body fluid, in a sense. Like I paint with a lot of reds and whites and just very high pigmented jewel kind of tones, and you know, my birds match my paintings, my plants match my birds, and then, you know, etc., etc. So I think with photography, even though bizarrely my favorite ever photographs that aren't mine are black and white, you know, like Chris Killip's In Flagrante work is like, I've just literally referenced it like 100 times today about something, and like all of the ephemeral kind of, not necessarily street photography, but like inverted commas real life photography as opposed to curated fashion stuff, is all my favorite work. So it's like the complete antithesis of the stuff I make. But I think I'm also a massive big round control freak, like a big control freak. So when it comes to like creating and curating and staging situations, it definitely tickles that one. But then I don't know.
Tell me more about your control freakness. Is that about sort of cultivating your own sort of visual world and having a tight hold on that?
Basically, after my father died, it lifted hugely. So, you know, sort of give that to a psychoanalysis to sink their teeth into. But the blanket of anxiety and stuff would just dictate my like daily, every single like micro decision. And so I guess the control thing comes from just trying to hone my like agency in a situation, I guess, and just have agency over my life. And I'm feeling like that's very, you know, very gladly that's going away thanks to therapy and being on the right medication. And I honestly don't even think about it anymore. Like only when I talk about past stuff does it come up. But I think it has informed the way I live and the way I work. And it's like, I think it's like creating a controlled sense of, I mean, what's the opposite of control?
You chaos? Tell me.
Yeah, chaos, but in like a...
Or maybe it's more about not caring.
Just like a freedom and of being, I guess, which is something I very rarely got to experience for like 10 years. And so I think it's like, because I think recently, and especially over lockdown with the self-portraits I did, which were funny, and even though that time felt like such a loss of, you know, like it was really taken away that time, you know, going from 27, 28 to 30 suddenly felt like very much like those 2 years of my last 2 years in my 20s were really taken from me, as I'm sure everyone else felt the same. But kind of honing an aesthetic that felt aligned to the level of painterly kind of composure like sort of having an image that's quite themed by something quite deliberate, but also making it feel quite ephemeral and escapist and believable. I think there's like a lot. I mean, the reason why generally I'm not bothered about fashion photography as a whole, as aesthetically, like I don't have fashion. I never had fashion posters on my wall. I never had fashion magazines like tear outs on my wall. Nothing like that. It was always like artwork and art photography. I just think it, because if it feels super, it's like why I hate CGI. I hate CGI in films because you're like, yeah, but it's just not real. It didn't happen. Yeah. And it's like a lot in it, just if something feels very inorganic and like you're being tricked, and it's like, well, I'm not that stupid. I know it's a trick. You're not kidding me. You're not fooling me. And it's like with fashion photography, it's like, well, you're not fooling me. This is a lot of posts. This is like 17 like white male editors like faffing around about, you know, X, Y, and Z, and it all just feels a bit convoluted and annoying. So to try and get, and I think actually this plays into why I'm not photographing huge commercial campaigns, because I think I very consciously try to stop my work looking super commercial, because super commercial equals, you know, contained and controlled and relatively generic and contrived. And so I think it's like trying to find that balance of like I've always said, it's like if that we're doing a photo shoot or whatever, and that the models are just there regardless of whether we're there or not. Like it's a world or a universe that's being created that we happen to fall into. That's the kind of, you know, or like when I did my self-portraits, it was, the first ones were very stylized and like kind of self-aware and whatever. And I was speaking to Alice Sue about it, and she made a point of like the best self-portraits in her mind are when you let go and you just don't give a shit. And it's like, you're not worried about being ugly and you're, you know, whatever. And I hated the idea that in those self-portraits, I was in any way trying to be seen as like hot or attractive, because I was like, it cringed me out so much that people thought I was like doing these sexy. I had someone's sister send me a photo of like a naked girl on a horseback doing a self-portrait, being like, it's really reminded me of your work. And I was like, no, no, please. I think that's when the arse candle came out.
Yeah, how did I was gonna say, how did the arse candle come out? No, how did that body of work start?
It started when, so everyone was doing self-portraits in like the first lockdown, but they all seemed to be very morose and like, hand on a frosted window looking out while their partner slept in bed in the same room with a crumpled duvet that looked like it hadn't been washed. Because, you know, why do we bother washing our duvets when no one's going to see them? Well, you've just taken a photo and submitted it to Days, so that answers that question. But and I was just very like, don't want to be, you know. And then I was talking to Harley about it, and then Harley made a nice point, being like, well, you know, it's also still a movement. It's still something that's happening, and maybe being kind of a part of that zeitgeist is kind of an interesting thing. And it made me think, well, yeah, I mean, art movements happen, and you know, fashion trends happen, and this is like a microcosmic little world shift, which is maybe quite an interesting thing. And I was like, you know what, I'm cutting my nose to spite my face here. I have this gorgeous house with my studio here, with access to all my gear. I have my boyfriend that can help me with stuff. You know, it's like, it seemed really silly to just discount it based on some weird something niggling me about, you know. But then I was like, well, if I'm going to do it, it's not going to be somber and static and flat and boring or whatever. I'll just make, you know, turn myself into a bit of a, like a playground, I guess, and like the intention was to use my body as a kind of prop. And then I found out that I found it weirdly annoying that it could, because I conform to like a societal standard of what, like, you know, like a slim, blonde, young woman. I was like, actually, it's quite funny to try and subvert that and to try and like uglify myself, because it really annoyed me that people would think that I was just trying to take sexy selfies amongst the cacti. And I was like, no, that's so awful. So yeah, so then I started thinking about how to just be gross or just funny. Like, it really pisses me off how like women in art and photography, I mean, there are obviously cases, and you know, they're out there, but generally the visual language surrounding women's bodies are of like very specific limited tropes of like, you're being you know, it's very elegance or softness or and actually, interestingly, the one I find the most annoying is empowerment. Like, mm-hmm. She's a hero, she's you know, empowering her. And I was speaking with a birth coach recently for the book I'm making about the problems and like the dangers basically of stereotyping like Black women as like the strong Black woman and like the empowered Black woman, and how it actually roots from like a really fucked up past of like, I mean, I won't get into it, it's probably quite triggering, but for all sorts of reasons, the sources of gynecology and how that was founded on Black slave women, and that's why women are seen as like the strong, because they just put, oh, you know, it's just a nightmare. But there's this whole historic significance to these tropes that we herald as like hashtag strong woman, like, you know, whatever, or like, you're a hero for surviving cancer, or you're a hero for having triplets. And you're like, no, I'm fucking not. My body's doing its job, you know. I'm doing this because it's being done to me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I feel like with imagery of women and, well, non-men, basically non-cis white men in art, it's like, how come Jürgen Teller gets to like get his arsehole out and shit on a piano or something? I want to be able to do that without never working again, you know? It's like, how come men are allowed, like, given such allowances for being fucking weird? And like, you know, I mean, they've been given allowances of far more than being fucking weird, but, you know, with all sorts of Me Too stuff and blah, blah, blah. But I feel like we're so shortchanged with what we're like allowed, how we're allowed to be perceived. And it's like, yeah. I want to be an ugly, gross freak and make you feel sick because that was that we've never been allowed to do that and been, you know, credited as, oh, I get to see the artistry in it. Before, it would have just been like, lock her up, put her
burn
away,
her.
Burn her now. But yeah, so that's kind of where it was angling, and then obviously lockdown lifted, things got busier, and the whole kind of point of the self-portraits was fun and exploratory stuff, you know. I wanted to see where my boundaries are with what actually made me uncomfortable, like, you know, what could I do that I thought, you know what, actually I don't want my 25-year-old brother to see this of me. But I was like, you know what, Don't know yet. I don't think there is anything. You've seen it all. Because it's just, I don't know, I think the body is such a funny thing. Like, our bodies are so, like, they're propped up as these, like, magnificent or, like, judged. And I don't know, there's just so, I'm like, this is, their bodies are really funny and, like, a bit silly and gross, and we've all got them. And no one's, yeah, just, like, there's no, they're just such weird little funny things. And I don't know, and, like, what's scary about them? Bodies are so scary to so many people, whether it's their own bodies and what they could turn into or what they've become or like what they represent or what they could, like, God forbid, what a woman's body could actually do, and like how that's meant, how that's, you know, so controlled and manipulated. And like, I'm reading this fascinating book by Jacqueline Rose on essays, it's on the cruelty of motherhood, about how, and it really fascinates me, the kind of hatred that women's bodies receive from men in the way that they get, you know, abortion laws and what we are and aren't allowed to do with them, and how if we can, you know, commodify them in the, under our own age, all that kind of stuff. Mm. And it's how, like, and it's ultimately that the fact that we, the thing that we can do of giving life, like, you know, in the way it's like godlike, and it's like that men can't facilitate that, you know, cisgendered men can't facilitate birth and the creation of life, and it gets their goats so much that they cannot do this thing, and so we're going to control the shit out of it, and we're going to tell them how they navigate it, and we're going to give them allowances of what they can do with that magical body that we find, you know, kind of terrifying and that they came out of, you know. And it's like, I don't know, it's funny. So to kind of subvert that and to be like, you know, I want to turn my body into this gross thing that you're meant to want to shag. But I bet you don't now. You know,
that work is so interesting. What did it feel like to you to actually be in front of the camera, though? Like, emotionally, what did that demand of you? Because I know you're a bold person, but it still takes quite a lot of vulnerability to do some of the things you did.
I found it like a turn on. Like, I found it really arousing. Like, I loved it. And if I didn't love it and I did feel vulnerable and if it wasn't something enjoyable, there's no way I would have done any more. Like, I did it because I felt like great. Like, I felt weirdly so aroused making myself like gross.
That is brilliant.
And I mean, it's annoying because I feel like there's only a couple shots that really touch on it. Like, I feel like the majority of the shot, by the way, it was all towards a book, and the aim was to, you know, collaborate with people, which some went slightly wrong and some went very well. And then it got to the point where I was like, I actually don't know how long this is going to take, and I don't want to add parameters on it, and I literally might publish it when I'm like 80 and I've done weird self-portraits throughout my whole life, which would be amazing. But I just wanted to get them out there in the world. But the ones that were published, I don't know, I'm kind of not, I mean, individually, I think they're some of the pictures I like, but as a collection, I'm very like unfulfilled by the fact that it doesn't quite like get across what I've just talked about as much as I would. Like, so some of them are just too fantasy and too pretty, because at the time that was kind of just the point of them at the time was the making of them and the doing of them and the like stimulation of just painting myself silver and walking around butt naked in Dulwich Park amongst the rhododendrons, because, you know, why not when you're in lockdown? But now I'm like, no. Now if I could do them again, I'd start from scratch and really try and get to the nitty-gritty of like what it was that made me feel too uncomfortable to publish as an image.
It's exciting to think where they might go.
Yeah, I don't, at the same time, I don't feel, I'm definitely giving it a hiatus because there's more important shit to shoot, basically. There's just more important stuff to say. I'm much more engaged in the project of birth and pregnancy, and I'm finding, I mean, I'm so just at the very, very beginning of it, and I'm, you know, enjoying navigating like which is the best route to take and which is the best source of consultation and advice, because it's, you know, who am I, some like non-mother who's some 30-year-old privileged white girl, to just barge in and like, you know, interrogate themes of pregnancy with race and gender, that, you know, so it's like I'm going to try and I'm doing my research and speaking to a lot of people and going to take guidance with it and try and approach it from a very sensitive and like not only way, you know. But then saying that, it is kind of, I'm finding it personally does relate to me, because it's like I'm at the age now where my friends are considering having kids and are already having children. And it's like, for my entire life, I've been so set on a given that I'll be a mother. My mother was a child's nurse. You know, I've always had tiny creatures that I've nurtured, and my Pomeranians are literally the amount of times I've wanted to suckle Flower. You know, it's problematic. But doing this and really learning about how much is not even like unknown, but like we're not supposed to know about the whole concept of motherhood and like where all these really fucked up stereotypes, like the origins of them from like Greek tragedies and mythology that's just bled through into like our systemic sort of sexism. And it's just fascinating. And it's like, so it's beginning to really make me suss out the pros and the cons of the whole thing. And yeah, I feel like that is a project that's much more apt and relevant and necessary. I'm gonna basically quit. I'm a bit of an all my eggs in one basket kind of gal, you know. It's like, if I'm gonna really focus on something, I'm gonna become like obsessed with it for however long it takes to like poop out like a product of that obsession.
I don't think this about all topics, but I think it's actually really important for people who are interested or intrigued by pregnancy or birth or having children or parenthood to explore stuff like this before.
I think so. I think it should be critical learning before.
Yeah. I mean, it definitely should, just from a practical level, but I just mean from an artistic perspective, there's just no dialogue around this anyway. So any take on it is super valid, because I can tell you it's such a cliche, but there is nothing that can prepare you for the reality of what it is. There is nothing, and no matter how much, you know, you have honest, I'm air quoting, conversations with people you know who've done it, they don't tell you. And I can tell you, as someone who's got a kid, the people who have kids have secret conversations amongst themselves, and that is often the only safe space where they feel like they can say all the shit they want to get off their chest.
Because it's shameful, right, to be pregnant or a mother and to be like, this is kind of shit sometimes.
I don't think, for me, it's not shameful. To me, it's like the fucking hardest thing you'll ever do in your life. And there's and like, when you say, oh, it's fucking hard, we all have hard experiences, right? But this is hard in a way that I have found that losing somebody isn't hard, that, you know, an impossible nightmare job isn't hard, like really hard things are not as hard as this. And I think that's why it's one of the things that radically changes your feminism overnight. Because you realize that all of that shit that you thought was biased before about women's bodies, about how you could be in the world, like when you're a mother, it's like, fuck me, everything is against us. And that's me saying this as just, you know, a queer white woman. So it's fucking wild. And so I think all these perspectives are so interesting. You know, that Maggie Shannon, it's like a completely different realm, but Maggie Shannon did that project about people giving birth in the pandemic, and she hasn't had kids. But I think one of the reasons why that work is so good is because she's coming to it and she sees things that I don't think you'd see as someone who's been through it. She sort of manages to extract these different moments that say something completely different. So I think it's so valid what you're doing.
Okay, well, that's promising then, because there is a sort of imposter feeling of treading on ground that it's not mine to tread on, but then it is, because I'm probably going to be a mother in a few years. So it's like, you know, it's like excavating the truths, but to then kind of like take them head on when I meet them, but like with this like ask, sort of, you know, like I'm ready for it in a sense. Not I will never be, as you say, you can never ready yourself for it, but I'd rather like be aware of what to look out for. And like speaking to, you know, doulas and things, and it's, you know, I didn't realize there are now death doulas to coach people through. I mean, apparently there always has been, it's just, for me, it's new. Death doulas, and you think, like, we're so sterilized West mm-hmm. as a Western society. And I think, mm-hmm. you know, art, photography related as well. I mean, that's what the podcast is about. But everything's quite sterile and no one's scared, everyone's scared to be messy or, I don't know, or it's such a rose-tinted bullshit thing to navigate. And I didn't even realize to the extent until, like, I've got a few friends now that are pregnant, one of which is sort of just considers being pregnant as a condition. Like, she's like, I just feel like, you know, speaking to this birth coach I was with, and they were saying it felt like it was being done to me. And this apparently is an incredibly common thing, but men, you know, people who are sort of in charge and get to dictate what's correct and what's not, and, you know, via consumerism and all sorts of other stuff, it's like they don't want to know that. It's like they did this to us, but they don't want to know the kind of aftermath of actually how crappy it is. And it's like I feel like next time someone says to me, like, so I'm pregnant, I'm having a baby, I feel like I'm going to be like, oh, are you okay?
That's what I say to people.
Are you okay? Because it sounds like the most insane thing you'll ever have to go through. And it's in, like, no time. And, you know, speaking actually photography-wise, it's kind of convenient as far as deadlines to make this book happen and to find subjects. And there's no dilly-dallying. If I find someone that is a brilliant subject for the photograph, for the book, it's like I have very limited time before that pregnancy is gone. And it might make it great for me. But, yeah, I think it's going to be fascinating because I actually, because you were with Riposte, yeah, of course you were with Danielle when you guys commissioned me to do the cover.
I love those images.
And they're some of my favorite pictures. And actually, it was that was the catalyst to what I'm doing now. But it had a few years of rest as such, because it was like it was quite spontaneous. I think, and I wasn't expecting. What was the theme of the magazine? Was it motherhood?
No, I don't think it was. It was something broader than that, because that's why
relationships or connection, or it was something. Because I remember there was a lovely cover of people kissing, and and it was like, okay, yeah, pregnant belly, let's go. And I cast a few women, of which all, of course, were, you know, middle class, white, attractive, and slim. And it's just, that's a whole other conversation. You put a casting call out for pregnant mothers looking to subvert some cliches, and you get like about 13 stylists that are around age 36 who are comfortable with posing nude, and you're like, well, yes, of course you are. Of course you are. Yeah. You know, it's that's a big part of what the book's going to be about, how it's like I can't talk. The snake eating its own tail, basically, of like, you have women coming forward who are happy to be nude and happy to be pregnant because they're white, and the society has told them, you know, we love to listen to you and we want to see you, and then we see them, and then the old women that don't know like that think that they don't want to be seen, and so they don't come forward, and it was like, ah. So casting is a nightmare, but especially because my echo chamber on Instagram. But and so I did those photographs of pregnant bellies, quite tight crops. I think I did the crops without actually consciously realizing that, because I didn't want it to be about the kind of cliched white pregnant woman. So by being almost abstract in proximity, it was like making it much more about the form. I didn't actually consider it then, but that must have been a reason. And it was such a beautiful, lovely thing to photograph, because it was like you're in a room with a stranger and they're naked, and you'd argue that they're a stranger to themselves because they have this alien body that they've just been, you know, it's just happened to them. So they're getting to know themselves almost as you're getting to know them. And it's like, you know, you make all these different kind of analogies of their spaces are kind of like, by that point when they're at the 9 month stage, like they've nested and these sort of spaces are baby readied, and it was very like nesty and womb like and intimate. And then just to be allowed into that space was a really like precious thing that I really enjoyed. And it's almost like I touched on it in an interview with another, it's like my friend Renee in Mexico was saying when she has her photo taken, she feels very guarded and awkward and doesn't know what to do with her body. But when she was completely naked and I was taking her photograph, she was like, oh, I can just be myself. I feel no like tension in my body. I'm And it's like, I feel like it's like when you're so exposed and so vulnerable, it's like you just give in and it's like you just allow. And it's like you've got nothing to kind of hide in a sense. And you're just like, well, fuck it, I'm naked now. I'm bared, you know, it's all out.
To build on that and also just go back to what we were just talking about related, because I'd hate to send the wrong message. But so I had an amazing pregnancy and an amazing birth. Like what I think is hard is being a mother, like the work of motherhood, I think, is what's hard. And I know a lot of people have very traumatic pregnancies.
Yeah.
And very
it's so diverse,
births.
Right?
So it is really diverse.
It's just
for sure.
Each to their own. It's actually shocking how diverse it is and how we, but there's this, we have one story of which, if you don't align to, like, it's a bit.
But this is exactly why women struggle, because you're told this story of the hard bit is that journey, that initial journey of like a year and then that culminates in this one birth moment, however that manifests, and nobody talks about afterwards, and it's afterwards that actually is the thing. But to go back to those images, like I felt like I was godlike when I was pregnant, and I know that sounds weird, and I'm not a particularly self-confident person, but it did something for me that I was like, I am growing a fucking human. What is more insane and powerful than that? And that it made you have it made me feel like unselfconscious in a way that I had never felt in my entire life. And that really came to me with those pictures you did for us, because there was something about that really radiated that. So it's nice to hear that the person you photographed felt like that, because it really did capture that moment for me.
That's so nice. Oh, no, the women I photographed were definitely very contented and celebratory of their pregnancies. And I think I wouldn't want to create any work in a book that was, again, just aligned to one story of like all the women that hate being pregnant. I think that would be one of the most depressing books of all time. No, it needs to just touch on everyone, everything. You know, I want to do animals. I would love to do a birth photograph of a Pomeranian giving birth. That's going to be like the ultimate one. So
that,
you know,
I
will be in touch with all the pom breeders. No doubt I'll come home with like six in my bag.
Yes.
little like party bag gifts at the end of the launch. Just get a pom.
That is amazing.
But yeah, and I think it just needs to be, it just needs to annihilate the whole preconception of all preconceptions and just be like, we birth, we shit, we eat. We fuck.
Repeat.
We're just like, repeat. And it's like, but then paint, a lot of birth photography I find is it's either very highly graphic and highly medical and like, oh, you know, with a little blurred sensor thing on Instagram, and you click it and you're like, good God. Or it's, and again, there's no wrong. Like, you know, I'm glad these images exist. Very glad they exist. But I just feel like there's no leveling up with like aesthetic and like what where we can go with it. I think there's no like juiciness and richness and artistry really in the actual creating and the craft of the images as such. I mean, there is some. I know some people do it very well, but generally, it's like quite difficult to find what it is I'm trying to make. And I guess that's why I want to make it. So and I get, but then at the same time, I really want to just carve itself into its own little shape, because I don't want to put too many parameters around what it needs to be. But I'm excited
for it.
About it.
Yeah, I'm excited for you.
We both said we're excited about it at the same time.
Yeah, we're excited. There's a lot of energy around it. How do you deal with self-doubt?
Mum.
Creatively, what can you not live without?
Pomeranians.
How do you deal with the pressure to follow up after one project finishes?
I don't really put myself under any pressure. I mean, I do, but I let it rest if it needs to. It will come along, you know.
What does art enable you to do, or creative work enable you to do, that you wouldn't be able to do if you were working in another field?
Freedom of time, massively freedom of time and travel, I think.
Do you think photographs still have the power to shift thinking and consciousness?
Yes.
What matters more to you, the process of making your work or the final image?
I grapple with that all the time. And I have said quite a few times after quite a few shoots now, even if the photos don't come out, I don't care, because it was so gorgeous just making them, you know. But generally, if it's been really gorgeous making them, it means that I won't sleep until I've seen them as the, like, you know, the baby born from that time, you know. It was like, it's like shooting the images is the sex, and then the photographs is like the little perfect baby that poops out. But it's like, yeah, like a shoot I did for Review, a beauty shoot where Steffi Cook's in the, I call it the Pookini. I made a clay bikini that looked like she's wearing, and it was like made out of, literally looked like shit, and like clumps kept falling off, and it was like, like hit the ground. And I was like, Steffi, please, like, hold it together. But like that day of just like women, and it was so hot, and everyone was sweaty, like deliriously hot. And, you know, we were having like ice lollies and Deliveroos, and it was like laugh. It was like, it was just such bliss. And I was like, my God, I'm so glad this is what I do. And that, for, compared to painting, any day I'll take photography, because it's like the collaborative, like once you can get the collaboration, the people in the room, like that balance right, the dynamics right, it is sheer heaven having like women that you so admire and respect, and stylists that you, so, you know, they're your close friends. And especially coming out of lockdown, that shoot was just especially just, you know, heavenly. And, you know, we just sort of scrapped all the fancy lighting setups and just let the sun beam in, and like doused people in oil and water, and just like, you know, and it was like very sensuous, and just like, I don't know, it was like this, it was very cathartic, and like, like genre, and like the world didn't exist beyond that room, you know. It was just gorgeous. And
I love
and
it.
And then, you know, when I was in Mexico, and for one of the first portraits I did for this pregnancy and birth book, I was introduced to a weightlifter who was 8.5 months pregnant. And she was amazing. Big belly, covered in tattoos, like very strong, very muscular. And her partner's a bodybuilder. And I went to their home, and it was just like, they were just completely naked, and it was so baking hot, and we were just covering her in water, keeping her cool as she was lifting huge weights above her head. And her dog, all the dogs were like running around, and one of the dogs, is her partner, lifted this huge weight above his head, so his hands are out of action. One of the dogs came and just sniffed his dick, and I was like, that's amazing. And like those little tiny moments of, you know, spontaneity that you don't get them if you're so hyper controlled and curated on a fashion shoot, because you've got, I don't know, tens and tens and tens of thousands of pounds at stake, and, you know, clients to impress and boxes to tick, and to just not allow for those moments is just devastating for me. And I'm hoping that now, you know, the industry seems to be waking up to the fact that people aren't dumb, and they don't like to be sold the same boring aesthetic, and like, they like to be tested, and they like to scroll through their endless millions of pictures and land on something that's a bit weird that they don't really get, because it stimulates them beyond just another airbrushed Yves Saint Laurent makeup advert or something. So I'm really hoping that as like, I'm just here at the right time, you know, like I'm hoping that as it goes on and progresses, that I'm going to be like made allowances to just have that trust for that spontaneity, which hopefully will then create a nice balance between the two. But no, to answer your question, I don't know. I think it's, one doesn't exist without the other, you know. It's like, it's like I enjoy the moment knowing that the photos are going to be fucking lush, and then I enjoy the photos knowing that moment was fucking lush.
Love
you
it.
Know, and it's like it comes through.
Yeah, it does.
You know, you can like, have certain photo shoots where you're like, that model was pissed off, hungry.
Yeah.
That shoe was obviously eight sizes too small, and she probably just misses her dog back in Copenhagen.
Yeah,
you know, you can tell. This is why Hammer Flower with me all the time, and it's so like you can tell that shit. And and people kind of slightly like that aesthetic. It's very 90s, but no, not now.
Steph, honestly, it was such a pleasure to talk to you.
God,
thank
I'm sorry
so
I really
much.
Ran on I'll ramble on
no you were fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for listening to The Messy Truth. You can find more information about today's guests in the show notes. Theme music is Change by Judd Greenstein from the album Awake, and design is by Ruby White. You can follow updates on the podcast on my Instagram at Jem Fletcher or subscribe to my newsletter at jemfletcher.com. Feel free to leave a review on Apple Podcasts.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.